You do.
Now, something we don't really want to talk about. Ah, ICE 1, Module 8, Part 3. Copyright issues. This is something we do have to mention because it is important and you can get into lots of trouble if you do not pay attention to this. It is your responsibility as a PC technician to know the copyright and licensing limitation of CDs, or at least know somebody who does. You need to become familiar with the copyright or licensing agreements associated with the purchase to avoid conflicts with legal issues. And the reason you want to do that is because legal issue conflicts are really expensive and you're usually not rich enough to pay. So stay on the right side of the law.
I don't think anyone would be rich enough to pay with what they'd hit you with.
No, no, well, this is it. And especially with the proliferation of portable media devices and the amount of R music duplication that occurs, you can be in quite a lot of trouble as to what should and what shouldn't happen. Now, let's talk about digital audio extraction.
Yes, as opposed to other types of extractions.
That's right.
Which we all don't like.
That's right. The availability and relatively low cost of CD recorders and the compatible media has basically upset the music industry quite significantly because most people can make up a CD very cheaply, and that most people can do it. Since the inception of audio CDs, people have desired the ability to create their own custom CDs while keeping the quality of the music. However, I believe that that's not entirely legal, but depends on who you talk to. Just because you own all the original CDs, I don't know whether you're necessarily allowed to make a compilation CD, whether that's legal or not.
That's an interesting point.
Compilation CDs?
Yeah.
Stuff you own? Yes, but the law's changed in Australia, so you could.
Ah, that's right.
It used to be illegal.
It used to be illegal, so there you go.
It's still illegal in the US, though.
That's right. Not that most people take any heed, but it's if you ever get caught, you see, it's a problem. Digitally audio extraction, which is something that...
Digital,
did I say? Yes. It makes this possible. Basically, you... DAE is the process of copying audio from the CD to another medium whilst keeping the audio in the same original digital state.
It's also known as ripping.
It is. All this very emotive people, these computer people, you're ripping and burning. It's all very, wild. And most users use DAE techniques to put tracks and songs from their audio CD onto the computer hard disk, and then they put it back onto a recorded CD. Keeping the songs in all digital format greatly reduces the chances of audio discrepancies. And if you also use some excellent ripping software, for example, Exact Audio Copy, www.exactaudiocopy.de, that is also a program that ensures the quality of your CD ripping, and there are similar applications for the Mac which I can't remember the names of.
Which Ian may know?
Possibly not. Kieran would be the one to talk to about that.
Okay.
Yep. When a CD player or drive plays a Redbook CD, which is the format in which audio is recorded, the drive performs a digital to analog conversion in real time, so that the audio can be played through speakers. Before digital audio extraction, this audio had to be recorded and it sounded filthy. And you could record that onto the computers, onto the hard drive, and you could copy that onto CD, but it really did sound horrible. This digital to analog to digital conversion was very time consuming and sounded horrible. Did I say that?
You did.
Unwanted noise, which was sort of what I was getting at. Okay, the quality of the CDs, and it really depended, and it wasn't very good, so they managed to get this direct digital extraction to happen, and this you can make nearly flawless copies, or you can at least make bit-perfect copies if you use Exact Audio Copy, see previous advertising. copying the songs from the Redbook CD is much different than copying a file from the CD. You have to use different software. Songs are stored in tracks on the CD, and the drives read through the tracks as the CD spins under the laser assembly. Since the audio information is streaming to the drive, special digital audio extraction software, such as Exact Audio Copy, must be used. This software reads the raw information off the CD. It usually reads it in cooked mode, but we don't go into that. And it sticks it into the audio file format of your choice, normally .wav if you're using Windows, or AIFF if you're using Macintosh. The WAV file can be then played to the computer, or it can be copied back onto a recordable CD, or it can be burnt as audio onto a recordable CD. When DA is used to create the WAV files on the computer, those WAV files are uncompressed and can be quite large, but that's okay because we all have big hard drives. Other audio formats such as MP3 and OGG don't sound as good. Compress these files down, and that is what you normally do if you're going to copy the stuff onto your portable player, such as your iPod TM or similar device.
So we're now going to go and talk about the DVD drive, the digital version of disc or a DVD, which is a newer technology, and it builds upon the strength of its CD-ROMs. And the DVDs share the same physical size as a CD-ROM, but they actually handle a lot more data or information. And we probably know them best for movies and audio, but also for data. So dependent on the layering and single or double-sized disc, DVDs can store close to 20 times the amount of information as a single CD can. So the capability to store information is because they provide a greater area for data storage, use a higher density recording technique, and can access multiple layers within the media. The two major markets for DVD players, basically the home entertainment market, I don't think there's too many people with that one now, and the computer DVD drive market.
And in fact, some software such as SUSE Linux, and I'm not sure about Vista, but some operating systems are only shipped on DVD. Does Vista come on DVD yet? Does anybody know?
It must have, yeah.
Yeah, I think
they distribute all versions of it on a single DVD.
Ah, right. Well, there you go.
So most, as I said, means most of us have got a DVD player at home.
Okay.
The movies that we get on the DVD media are digital reproductions, and they've got better colour, vivid colour, theatre-style surround sound, and they've got lots of other movie-related extras, like where you get the chapters that you can go and sort of see how it was all made, and, you know, chapter by chapter blows on each of the DVDs.
I think there could be a demand for a if we did a DVD of a Cavi DVD, we could have commentary.
Cavi FM commentary.
Yeah, we could have commentary. We could go, oh yeah, DVD ROMs. I remember doing this lecture. Yeah, it was that was one where we were talking about DVDs. Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, since the movie's recorded and digitally, the quality of the movie's as close to the film quality as possible, and they don't deteriorate like VHS tapes can.
Wow.
So they say.
Yeah, but I think you'll find that they get scratched, they get damaged.
They do,
And one of the things I'd like to caution people about here, they talk about the durability and indestructibility of optical media. There has recently been some research that indicates that in certain circumstances magnetic media is actually safer for long-term data storage than optical media, because they're not sure how long the chemical jiggery-pokery will actually stay stable before you start losing data off your CDs.
It's too early to tell, isn't it?
Really.
They haven't been around long enough.
That's right.
But the average home DVD player also offers you a number of audio options, and those include multiple audio channels, Dolby surround sound,
TM,
Dolby Digital 5.1,
TM,
and DTS,
TM.
So the computer DVD drives also play movies and music as well as read data discs, and a lot of the software manufacturers are now beginning to offer many of their products on DVDs.
That's because you don't have to ship as many CDs.
That's right, and they can now place their entire program on a single DVD instead of multiple lower capacity CDs, as Kerry just said. And one of the other benefits of DVD drives is that they are backwards compatible with CDs, and a DVD drive can read DVDs and CDs while your CD-ROM drive only reads CDs. So the DVD drives, though, are similar to the CD-ROM drives in their design.
However, they're heavier because they've got more smarts in them.
And the DVD drives basically comprised of a drive motor for spinning the disc, a laser assembly which reads the DVD, and a tracking mechanism for moving the laser assembly into the desired area, and communication circuits for moving the data to its destination. You'll also get another type of optional component, which is a decoder, and all of your home DVD players and home DVD drives have a MPEG 2 decoder, and that is for decompressing the video data into a format, there's a phone, that can be shown on a television screen or monitor. Also, some of your DVD players and drives contain audio decoders, which are for either the Dolby Digital 5.1 or DTS audio streams.
That hasn't been very popular because audio DVDs are extremely expensive, and they're just not as ubiquitous as CDs, and people really haven't got that excited about the technology. It does exist, just not very popular at the moment.
The decoders, though, they decompress the audio data and separate the information into the proper discrete channels. So the DVD players and drives that don't contain those decoders can use other hardware or software, and that also accomplishes the decoding. So the laser that's used in your DVD drive is different from lasers that are used in a CD-ROM drive. So the laser is actually has to focus on the different layers of the media, and while a single layer DVD has only a single reflective layer of material, the dual layer disc contains a semi-transparent layer that's over the top of a completely reflective layer, and the laser needs to distinguish between the two layers by focusing on the correct layer of the material that's containing the desired data.
Now, when you look at modern laptops and modern computers, most modern computers these days do ship with a DVDR/RWDL drive, and that's a dual layer one. So the dual layer discs are still relatively expensive compared to the single layer discs, but they do store twice the data, and I've never ever used one in my life, so there you go.
Dual layer?
Yeah.
You put them on to get a copy of Tiger Server. And it's no different, it's just bigger.
Oh, okay.
That's not a double sided.
No, dual layer.
Yeah, dual layer.
Yeah.
Yeah, just pop it in.
Yeah. 9.4.
Yeah.
Yeah,
just
boom. That's normal. Yep, fair enough. When installing a DVD drive, follow the steps for a CD-ROM drive installation because they look very similar.
And don't forget your safety procedures.
Obviously not. and we don't want to... I don't think we need to go through all those steps. I think our people are smart enough to figure that out. The only thing I would mention, though, is if you want to be able to play audio DVDs... DVD movies and things, you also have to install the software that comes with your DVD-ROM drive. Otherwise, it doesn't play audio DVDs or movie DVDs.
Now we're going on to talk about the recordable DVDs. So
computer demands for removable storage optionally has prompted the industry to develop methods of recording DVDs. Yes. Currently, there are four different methods of DVD recording. Isn't that good?
I was waiting for you to say, yes, I remember that well.
Well, interestingly enough, this has been a one of the problems with the optical industry and the industries in general is they come up with one standard and then they think, let's confuse the trop out of consumers and come up with three more different ones that are subtly incompatible with each other just to cause you grief. Mm. Each of the techniques is varied, it's varying by the standard DVDs. So you've got DVD recordable, DVD-R.
Yep.
DVD-R is similar to CD-R technology, which is allows the media to be written to once only. This method is often used for DVD authoring and is not very practical for consumers due to the price of drives, which is usually US dollars...
2,000.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. I'd say US $30 now, but that's all right.
Yeah, they've come down a lot in price, haven't they?
They have. Mm-hmm. These notes are a little bit dated.
Mm.
20 and the discs are actually come down to about $1 a disc. Even though the price is a drawback, which it isn't anymore, so we'll just skip that segment. But DVD RAM uses RAM technology, allows users to write and overwrite discs. They are still expensive, 100,000 times. I wonder if anybody's counted them. DVD RAM uses phase change technology.
Yes.
They have?
Okay. Whenever you do a rewrite cycle count, you do it automated and you count it. And this is how they find out how many times you can write to flash memory.
Yep.
How many times you can write to CDs and DVDs.
Yep.
And all that sort of stuff.
Yep. And
they are tested.
And you've spoken to somebody who's actually managed to kill their flash drive due to excessive rewrites.
I've killed my own.
You've killed your own.
The early ones you could only get a few hundred.
Right.
As in 800, 900.
Right.
You use it to put stuff on, take stuff off, put stuff on, take off all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Within sort of 6 or 8 months it dies.
Mm.
And what about these days, Ian? How long are they lasting these days?
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands, so give that to
the hard drive,
couple of years.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, in fact, I've got some little flash drives that, that's interesting. And it's interesting to know that these technologies do have limitations as to how much they can be used. There are people who are of the belief that flash drives and DVD RAM drives and things last forever, and they certainly don't.
Mm.
DVDs, however, can store 4.7 gig of information on each side of a DVD RAM disc. This DVD RAMs are priced below US dollar 1,000. Well, they're probably most drives do RAM these days, so.
Mm.
But the discs are a bit pricey. They're about $8 or $9 per disc. Depends where you buy them. Apparently, compatibility is not a compatibility issues with DVD RAM drives, as most of these drives require the use of a cartridge-based disc while recording. Well, that used to be the case. Now they don't tend to use cartridges very often.
And we're on to DVD read-write, which is technology that's designed to address the compatibility and re-recording issues. And it's geared more towards general use rather than authoring. DVD-RW is a caddyless system and allows you to rewrite information on the media approximately 1,000 times. So this media is compatible with most DVD ROM drives and standalone players that are on the market today. And the drive uses a sequential recording technology and it's used primarily for streaming media. So DVD-RW is capable of writing 4.7 gigabytes of information on each side of a disc. Then we've got DVD plus RW. And it's the latest DVD recording technology and has a lot of corporations which include Hewlett-Packard at the back of it. And
funnily enough, they sponsor these notes, which is why they're mentioned
here. I was just going to say that, actually.
Yeah.
There could be a reason. This is a sort of slight. This is a message from your sponsor.
That's right.
So, as with the DVD-RW, the technology is compatible with existing hardware and is easily written to multiple times. So the major advantage of DVD plus RW is its ability to use variable bit rate when encoding a number of types of information such as streaming video. And the major industry backing of this particular format, coupled with the affordability of the drive, and whether this is up to date or not, it's less than US 600.
I would say
probably
less than
not.
US 100.
Yes, yeah. Should find DVD-RW as the standard DVD recording format in the near future.
Yeah, just something to mention here is that both of your instructors, that's yours truly and hers truly.
And my truly,
yes.
Yeah.
We both have laptops that contain DVD-RW dual layer drives. That's how the technology has come out. I think yours has one, does it?
Yes.
Mine does.
Yes.
Yes. So we can burn rewritable DVD. In fact, I think mine can even do DVD RAM. It's a super multi. I'd say yours is a super multi too.
Mine's a super multi.
Yes. If they call it a DVD super multi, that means it can do RRW and RAM, hence the multi designation.
So laptops have come a long way too, haven't they?
They have.
So now we're talking about the CD recording formats, and Philips and Sony actually developed the format standards for audio CDs, and that was a bit of a history lesson here in the early 1980s. And then other manufacturers realised that the potential for using CDs to store information for computers was there, and they developed a number of more formats to ensure compatibility when recording CDs. So there are two major types of CD formats, and that's one is the logical standards and the second is the physical standards. So I'll just go through those. The logical standard actually defines the way information is stored on the media.
Now, if you want to know anything about this, because these notes are fairly brief on this topic, there is a document on the internet called the CD Recordable FAQ. Last time I looked, it was on www.fadden.com, but I'd Google that up because it may have moved, the CD Recordable Frequently Asked Questions, and it covers all aspects of CD rewriting and writing and the formats and things in much more detail than these notes are. But here's a summary just to whet your appetite.
So the CDs and other computer access discs actually use a series of discs and sectors.
Tracks and sectors even.
Also frames, that's what happens when you're reading fast, isn't it?
They're also called frames on the CD, which store the data on the disc. A CD logical standard defines its file system structure.
And currently the ISO 9660, also referred to as the High Sierra standard, sounds like a movie name, doesn't it, is the industry standard format.
It is, however, people decided that once DVDs came out that they wanted to store files bigger than 2 gigabytes in size, and they have moved more over to the UDF format, which is one that can store bigger files and has better support for multi-session recording.
But the ISO 9660 format can be accessed by most platforms and operating systems that are around these days. And some other formats such as Rockridge for Unix, HFS for Macs, and hybrid HFS ISO do exist, and they are used these days, but ISO 9660 is internationally accepted as the standard. The two formats that will actually improve upon ISO 9660 include Joliet. It depends on your French accent.
Merci Bucket. I don't know whether. I think most people just call it Joliet.
It sounds like Juliet. Yeah. Joliet.
There is actually a Romeo format, but it's not very commonly used, interestingly enough.
Don't tell me that. Romeo and Joliet.
That's right.
And UDF.
And okay. So Joliet
is in your exam, maybe.
It is. It is a Microsoft format, which is an extension to ISO 9660 that allows
maximum of characters in a file name from 8 to 64.
8 to 64, and the maximum of characters in a path name from 8 to 64, and it also allows multi-byte character sets such as Unicode, which is your funky Chinese letters and stuff, or Japanese letters or whatever. Okay, Universal Disk Format, or UDF. Well, good, I'm glad they told me that because I couldn't remember what that stood for. It's an emerging standard, now it's out there, built upon ISO 9660, specifically designed for data storage.
So then we go on to the physical standards, and they're standards which define where the information is placed on your CD. So most formats fall within the colour books, and Philips and Sony completed the format for audio CD, and the rules were published in a book with a red cover.
Yes.
How about that? And this format, for obvious reasons, became known as Red Book format, and basically is the basis of the naming conventions for the other colour book formats.
And yes, there are documents that will tell you what all of the colour books mean. Blue book and
we're actually going to go through some of those too.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one is Red Book, which is also known as CD-DA, or Compact Disc Digital Audio. And that particular format defines an audio CD, and it specifies how the songs are placed in tracks on the disc.
Yes, Yellow Book. The Yellow Book format was developed early on the official format for data. This format allows for the data to be written as files instead of streaming information.
And the next one is the Green Book. And in 1986, Philips created the Green Book format for its new CD-i, or interactive discs. And this format was designed to synchronise audio and video data for multimedia applications.
Mm-hmm. The Orange Book. I like oranges. that was 1990, was the Orange Book format standard, and it defines the physical format for CDs.
Mm.
The standard is subdivided into three parts.
Part one is magneto-optica, or MO, devices. Part two handles write-once, or WO, drives. And part three addresses rewritable drives.
And I think some of the write-once drives that actually allow you to write once, read many, are actually called worm drives, just as a, you know, interesting thing.
And we go on to these pretty colours again, Kerry.
The white book. This standard addresses the method of recording MPEG-1 audio, video, and graphics to video CD. CDR. The discs require a specialized player or software applications to access them, the information that's compressed onto the disc.
Mm. The next one is the Blue Book standard, and it specifies the format of enhanced CDs. And basically, enhanced CDs are stamped multi-session disc, and they feature the Red Book audio and Yellow Book multimedia data on one single disc. So.
Well, there you go. I'll just a bit pause.
Now we're back for DVD layering and formats. So even though DVD and CD media share the same physical size, I'm just laughing, someone's whistling. DVDs actually offer a lot greater storage capacity.
And they lose more data if you scratch them. Anyway, continue.
They do. But the reason they offer the greater storage capacity is through the use of a higher density data storing technique and through the use of layering. So, and DVD layering is actually a process in which the read layer of the drive is able to focus at different layers within the disk. So a dual layered disk has an equivalent of close to twice the surface area as a regular disk, and a dual-layered double-sided disc has almost four times the surface area on which you can store data.
Why almost four? Anyone? I don't know. Why currently there are three types of DVDs, apparently,
and
four physical formats. Isn't that good?
Mm,
the three DVD types are as follows. DVD-ROM, designed for storage of computer files.
DVD video, which is used for standalone DVD players and for movies and extras.
DVD audio, a newer format that includes multiple channel audio with many options, including digital rights management.
Mm.
DVD physical formats define the structure of the disc and areas to which data is recorded. You've got DVD 5, I think it's, yeah, that's right, DVD, it's supposed to be DVD-5, I think, but DVD-5, a single-sided, single-layer disc with the storage capacity of up to 4.7 GB.
And DVD-9, which is a single-sided, dual-layered DVD, and it has a total capacity of 8.5 GB.
DVD-10, a double-sided, single-layer, per side DVD with a capacity of 9.4 GB.
And the last one, which is a DVD-18, which is double-sided, dual-layer per side disc, and it has a total capacity of 17 gigabytes.
Gee, you wouldn't want to lose one of them, would you?
No, not really.
No. Okay, DVD characteristics. Layers per side, 1. Sides, 1. Capacity, 4.7 gig. Oh, this is a...
bit of a chart, I think.
Ah, it is. It's sort of a table. Length in hours, 2 hours. 2 hours.
And the layers per side, 2. You get side is 1. Capacity is 8.5 gigabytes. And the length is about 4 hours.
I assume that's 4 hours of video storage. Okay. Sides, 2. Capacity, 9.4 gig. Length, 4.5 hours. Layers per side, 2.
Sides, 2. Capacity, 17 gig. And length, 8 hours.
So there you go.
Now we're going on to digital cameras and video cameras.
Do you have a digital camera?
I do.
Yeah. In fact, I've got one in my... You've got two, actually. You've got one
last
in your
phone. Last time I said I do, I got into a lot of trouble.
Yes. So did I. I have a digital camera. There's one in my phone. And Gemma's got one in her phone. And in fact, we've got ones in our old mobile phones as well.
Yep.
And we also have a digital camera that takes pictures. So there you go. So
that's
digital
great,
camera is quite ubiquitous. Just sort of pointing out that lots of people have digital cameras now.
Yeah. And the video cameras on their phones as well. It's all getting so technical. I don't know.
I'm just going to pause for a second.
Okay, so we're now going on to digital cameras first, and then we're going to talk about video cameras. So digital still camera has a series of lenses, and those lenses focus light to create an image of a scene, and it's just like a conventional film camera. But it focuses the light onto a semiconductor device, and that device records the light electronically instead of focusing the light into a piece of film. And it's this electronic information that's then broken down into digital data by the computer. And that allows you to view, edit, email, and post your pictures to the internet. And a charge-coupled device, CCD, is the image sensor that's used by many of the digital cameras today. And CCDs are used to capture and store image data in telescopes, scanners, digital still cameras, and also digital video cameras.
You know, I actually heard a story the other day that one of the film companies, I'm not sure which one, has actually scaled back its production of regular chemical film because of the proliferation of digital cameras. Kodak?
Almost all the camera manufacturers no longer make film cameras.
Ah, well there you go.
How interesting.
A good CCD can produce an image in extremely dim light, and its resolution does not degrade in low light the way that those on film cameras do.
And the complementary metal oxide semiconductor, or CMOS technology that we all have talked about before, is used by some of the more inexpensive cameras.
Read cheap, trashy.
And although CMOS sensors, they are improving all the time, the CCD technology will continue to be the standard in the higher-end digital cameras for some time. And something you're going to get in your exam is what we're going to talk about now. Resolution is measured in pixels, and that is the amount of detail that the camera can capture.
Now the interesting... Oh, sorry, you just finish your next sentence and then I'll have another rant.
So basically, the more pixels you have means the more detail, better quality. And with low resolution pictures, they'll become grainy and look out of focus when they're enlarged.
Now, I must stress here, and obviously I'm not an expert on this because I'm blind, obviously, but it's not only the number of megapixels that are important on your camera, it's actually the quality of the lenses and the quality of the CCD. We have, my sister-in-law actually, has a camera that is quite small and quite snazzy and claims it does 5.1 megapixels. And the photos look relatively crummy compared to our Nikon Coolpix 5200, which is a much bigger camera but seems to have much better focusing, much better lenses and much better CCDs. So if shopping for a digital camera, do not just assume that the 12.1 megapixel camera is going to give you the greatest images. You could just end up with 12 million not very nice pixels.
That's a really good point actually.
And if you're going into a camera shop and you're looking at buying a camera, it's very important to see what sort of photos the camera takes before you put your cash down, if possible, because you can get good and bad cameras, and you really want to make sure that you can operate the thing and take decent pictures with it.
Having looked at just to digress here on cameras, and that we're talking about before is mobile phones having cameras, and these days, you know, some of the fascinating phones I looked at, if you're a real camera buff, some of the newer phones, just amazing what they've got in the way of cameras and video cameras on them. But they tend to get bigger, of course, again, because they've got all this whiz-bang camera technology in them. But it's
you also need a certain focal length for your lenses. I mean, you need a certain amount of space for the camera as well, so that increases the size of
But boy, very interesting if you're a camera buff.
Yeah, although a dedicated camera will always perform better than a phone with a camera jammed on the back of it. It's those people who don't want two things in their handbag.
Exactly. Okay. So the following gives you a list of the resolutions that are used by the digital cameras.
According to these notes, anyway.
Yeah. So if you've got 256 by 256 pixels, that tends to be used in the inexpensive cameras and produces a lower quality picture, and this is around 65,000 total pixels.
Ooh. 640 by 480 pixels. This resolution is used, but it is little better. It is an adequate resolution for emailing pictures and still looks crummy, and posting them on the internet. This is 307,000 total pixels.
And the 1216 by 912 pixels, that resolution is in the good range, and it's enough to print images, and you can also email them and post them. And this is a megapixel image with a size of 1,109,000 total pixels.
1600 by 1200 pixels. This is a high resolution, well, according to these notes. I think our cameras do 2516 by 1920, but that's all right. Good results are achieved when printing to larger sizes, like 8x10. This is almost 2 megapixels.
It's not uncommon today to get cameras with up to 10.2 million pixels, and they give you better results than the film cameras.
I just want to see who the hell's SMSing you.
Okay. So most of your digital cameras these days use an LCD screen, and that allows you to view and delete your pictures right away. You'd probably want to, the ones you decide to keep, you want to transfer them to your computer, so you've got a safer way of hanging on to them and using up less memory on your camera. So you can accomplish that in several ways. So the camera can have fixed storage, and that can be connected to your computer and allows you to download the images. And that connection can either be a serial, parallel, SCSI or USB port. And so a lot of the newer cameras, though, have got removable storage, and that allows you the images to be transferred to your computer or even directly to your printer without having to connect the camera to it. And there are a number of different types of storage. Well, the first is the built-in memory, and built-in flash memory is used by most of the inexpensive cameras. and smart media cards, which are small flash memory modules. Compact flash is another form of flash memory, and it's similar but slightly larger than smart media card. And your memory stick, which is a proprietary form of flash memory, and
it's used by Sony.
Used by Sony.
It is. And in fact, there are multiple flash formats and things, which is why a lot of the card readers you buy now say 32-in-1, which is all very confusing. So it's very important that you find out whether you want SD, MMC, MC, Compact Flash, MS, MS, Duo. Make sure that you're getting the right module for the right camera. Some cameras, they can store stuff on floppy disks, and that's not very fast, so not very cool. Some cameras have small built-in hard disks or PCMCIA hard disk cards, and they can store image storage on that. Some cameras can do writable CDs and DVDs. One of the problems with using this technology, such as writable CDs and DVDs and stuff, is they require a lot more power to run, and the batteries and stuff for the camera tend to be a lot heavier.
The writable CDs and DVDs would be used in the more expensive cameras, would that be right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So a drive or reader is required then to transfer your files from flash memory to the computer. And those type of devices, they're much similar in their behaviour to the floppy drives. They're inexpensive to buy, and they allow your images to be transferred to the computer without the use of cables. And I guess Bluetooth technology and all that these days, that does the same.
It does.
And the difference between the storage media basically is their capacity. And whilst a floppy disk is fixed, the capacity of flash memory devices, as we know, is ever increasing.
Okay, digital cameras use two main file formats, TIFF.
Which we don't want to have.
No. Tagged image file format.
Or JPEG.
Yes, which are not PEGs that you peg things on the line with. JPEG is a compression format, and TIFF is an uncompressed format. The JPEG file format is used most often for storing pictures, providing different quality settings such as medium and high.
Okay, and that's pretty good coverage on that, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Now we're going to talk a little bit about the video cameras or camcorders, and they've been around for around about the past 20 years.
Oh, we all remember Super 8, don't we?
And they're similar to the digital camera in that they use CCD, but the lens in a camcorder shines the light onto a CCD, and that measures the light within half an inch or one centimetre. And a panel or a 1 centimetre panel of 300,000 to 500,000 tiny light sensitive diodes, which are called photosites. And there are two types of video cameras, the analogue and the digital. The analogue camcorders record the video and audio signals as an analogue track onto a video tape. And every time a copy of the tape is made, it loses some image and some audio quality. So the analog formats lack a number of the impressive features that are found in digital camcorders, and the main difference between the available analog formats is what kind of videotape the camcorder uses and its resolution. Your analog formats include the standard VHS, and that uses the same type of videotapes as a regular VCR, and once they're recorded, they can be played on a standard VCR. The second analog format is a VHS-C, and that's a compact VHS format, and the video camera tapes are smaller, but they can be played on a standard VCR with the use of an adapter. Another one is the Super VHS, and Super VHS tape records an image with 380 to 400 horizontal lines, and is a much higher resolution image than standard VHS tape. And the video camera itself is a VCR and can be hooked up directly to a TV or a VCR to copy to standard VHS tapes.
Super VHS-C, a more compact version of Super VHS, which is used in smaller sized cassettes. Okay.
8mm?
8mm, yes.
Small. Sorry?
Yeah, okay, well...
Go for it, Kerry.
Yes, all right.
We won't fight. We won't have a tip.
No. No, we'll have a JPEG instead. Small 8mm tapes, about the size of an audio cassette. Oh, I don't know about that. I think they're smaller than that. Are used and provide about the same resolution as standard VHS. The advantage is that this format allows for more compaction, video recording, sometimes small enough to fit in your pocket. To view recordings that the video recorders, you attach it to television.
And then there's Hi8, which is similar to the 8mm camcorder. Hi8 camcorders have a higher resolution though, and they're about 400 horizontal lines. And Hi8 tapes are more expensive than the ordinary 8mm tapes. So the digital recorders record information digitally as bytes, and this allows the image to be reproduced without losing any of its image or audio quality. And digital video can also be downloaded onto your computer, and there you can be edited or posted on the internet. The digital video has a much better resolution than analog video, and typically around 500 horizontal lines.
Alrighty, mini DV. These video recorders can be very small and lightweight. They record on compact cassettes, which are fairly inexpensive and hold. Are fairly expensive, are they?
Yes.
Oh, it depends on that, I suppose so. And hold about 60 to 90 minutes of footage. The recordings are at 500 lines for resolution and can be transferred to a personal computer. They have the ability to capture still pictures just as a digital camera does. Sony has recently introduced Micro MV, a format that works on the same basic way as Mini DV, but records on much smaller tapes.
And Sony exclusively produces digital 8. And they're very similar to regular DV camcorders, but they use a high 8mm tape, which is less expensive and can hold up to about 60 minutes of footage. And digital 8 recordings can be copied without any loss of quality. And you can also connect them to your computer to download or edit or use on the internet.
I think we've talked about DVD video recorders. Mm. Not as common
when you compare them to mini DV models.
Ah, to mini DV, that's because they're big and heavy.
Yeah, that's right.
But they will gain more acceptance, I reckon. DV recorders burn video information directly onto small discs. The advantage is that each recording session is recorded as an individual track,
which is similar to the song tracks on your CD.
Yeah, fair enough. These tracks make it possible to jump around the sections of the video. DVDs can hold 30 minutes to 2 hours video. The newer DVD video recorders support two formats, DVD-R and DVD-RAM. DVD-R camcorder discs will work in most set-top DVD players. The discs can only be recorded to once, so we only get take one. DVD-RAM makes it possible to to record discs again and again, but they cannot be played in an ordinary DVD player. The video recorder is connected to the television to play the movies, and they can be copied to another format.
So the memory cards are like the digital cameras. The digital video recorders are available that record directly onto a solid-state memory card, such as a flash memory card or a memory stick and SD cards. And the hardware and software video capture, when you've got video clips, you can play them using Windows AVI format or through a video capture card. And if you're creating some type of presentation that includes a video component, that's very useful. And the sources for video capture would normally include VCRs and camcorders. And some capture cards actually include a RF demodulator and a TV tuner, so that video can be captured from a TV broadcast signal or a cable TV input. And the output from these video producing devices tends to be composite TV or analog S video signals. And a video decoder circuit is then used to convert the analog signal into a stream of digital signals. These are not, however, RGB digital signals, which are useful to the VGA card. The characteristics of the decoded TV signal are defined in the TV industry terms as YUV, and we talked about that a little bit earlier. And the digitised output from the A to D converter is applied to a video compression application-specific integrated circuit, or ASIC. Do you want to pause for a
minute? I'll pause.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yep.
And ASIC is a compression chip that reduces the size of the file by removing the redundant information from the consecutive frames. And that reduction is necessary due to the size of the typical digitized video files. And the video compression schemes can reduce the size of video file by a ratio of around about 200 to 1. And as the sections of the video are compressed, the reduced files can be applied to the system RAM or can be routed directly to the hard disk drive. And your audio signal is not compressed, but is actually synchronized to the video signal so that it will play in the right places when the video is actually run. So when the digitized video is recalled for output purposes, the file is reapplied to the compression chip, and that restores the redundant information to the frames. And the output from the compression chip is applied to the digital to analog portion of the video processing circuitry, and the analog signals are then converted back into the proper VGA format and are applied to the video capture card.
It is worth noting, however, that these compression formats are lossy, and when they do remove redundancy from the frame, not all of the redundancy is put back. So if you recompress and decompress a video too many times, you can end up with a loss of quality.
And as with any other adapter card, this requires that the outer cover of the system unit needs to be removed. Inside the system unit,
you remove the expansion slot's cover. Yep.
Over compatible expansion slot, which makes sure the expansion slot type is compatible with the capture card edge connector.
Otherwise, you need a hammer to put it in.
Oh, we have a few of them around here. Many of the capture cards are actually full-length cards, so then you need to make sure the slot can handle the physical dimension of the card, and you then connect the capture card to the VGA card as you would be directed by your installation guide. Or you can find more information on the internet, search the website of the manufacturer for the particular card that you're installing.
Or look up the forums where people are complaining about how the card doesn't work.
Mm. Some of the cards, VGA cards, use an edge connector built onto the top of the card, and you can then install any antennas, and they must be connected to the card for the intended application. And those things could include a TV antenna, coaxial cable from your TV, or a FM radio antenna. You then connect the video in cables to the audio and video source that's being used, and then the audio cable to the audio source. And in this case, there's a stereo audio in left-right position and two possible sources for video in. And the audio and video connections are typically made with a standard RCA cable and connector.
RCA stands for Radio Corporation of America, just in case you ever wanted to know.
You then connect the VGA monitor signal cable to the capture card VGA out connector, and the video signal then passes through the capture card and is looped to the VGA card.
Interestingly enough, most of this stuff is done by colours, so you get RCA for video and RCA for audio. Isn't that wonderful? So the colours don't actually have to be right, you've just got to make sure that the same coloured one is into the same coloured one, otherwise you can get some interesting results.
And after you've done all that, that would mean that the screen image would be present on the monitor and the video screen simultaneously. And a VGA loopback cable is connected between the capture card loopback input and the VGA card RGB output connector. And if all the hardware and software configuration settings are then correct, but you had capture problems still, you'd have to troubleshoot the video capture related hardware. And in most systems, this would involve a TV signal source, such as your VCR or camcorder, and the cabling, the capture card, and the video card. And most capture card software would provide a preview window, which would enable you to view the video coming from the video source.
If the source is visible in this window, then the video source and the video in cable can be eliminated as the source of the problem. However, simply being able to see the video in the video window does not mean that the card will capture video.
But if the video is present in the window and the video source and cabling check out, then the hardware and software configurations should then be checked. And you would check the capture software setup for the video buffer settings, and the usual video buffer settings are D0000H, D800H.
Oh, E000H to E800H.
Oh, well. Or E800H, yeah. And then you change the setting to one of the possible values. Add a device equals statement to the config sys file that corresponds to the new settings for the video buffer.
I would like to point out that this information is only valid for Windows 9X operating systems. You would not necessarily load drivers and config sys for Windows XP, and in fact most capture cards operate on the PCI bus. And they actually use shared PCI memory, which is usually handled by the computer. However, just for historical purposes, there's an example which says device equals path / EMM386.x, x equals D800H, I think, or D700H, and that excludes 16k of RAM from the address space. And you can finally reinstall and reconfigure the software that comes with the card.
And then if you've still got problems, the hammer always works.
That's right.
So if the signal from the video source isn't present in the preview window, you'd make certain that the video source is turned on. And we did have a little talk about turning on the buttons early, didn't we?
We did. And you would check the
video. How many people don't check it's turned on?
That's right. Check the video in cable to make certain that it is properly connected. In fact, I'd be doing all of that stuff before I started mucking around with
Confixes,
personally. And make sure that it's connected into the right place. It's pretty standard stuff.
And check the I/O address setup of the capture card closely, as well as its setting in the capture software. And you check the video capture software to make sure that the correct video source selected setting is selected. And while you're there, check the video type selected and make sure that it is for NTSC standard.
Well, if you're in America, so Americans want NTSC, never twice the same colour, and we want PAL in Australia.
Yeah, or PAL in Australia. Or the corresponding video standard used in the country or region of your preference.
That's the one.
And I think that sort of brings us to the end of this module.
Yeah, today we've
will be very pleased to know.
Today we've discussed all sorts of things, and we hope you have found those things enlightening.
Yeah.
Of course, if you have any questions, feel free to post to the mailing list.
Yeah.
Or talk to us on Ventrilo.
Yes, and we're hoping you're all enjoying the Ventrilo.
Well,
we certainly are.
Mm.
It's much better than what we had. And we're very grateful for that.
Yep.
So for now, it's goodbye from him.
And goodbye from her.